This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello and welcome to the Folklore Podcast. I'm Mark Norman, folklore researcher and author. Last year, back in episode 108, we welcomed Dr. Amy Jeffs onto the podcast to discuss her book Storyland, A New Mythology of Britain. I chatted with Amy about the book, whose premise was to retell and analyse some of the famous and some of the more obscure myths of the British Isles. Storyland went on to receive many accolades, including a Times Book of the Year award for historical fiction and other Book of the Year awards from the Daily Express and BBC History magazine, to name but a few. I'd like to think the Folklore Podcast played its part in pushing Storyland to those well-deserved awards. But it didn't. Amy's writing did that. As such, of course, we had to invite Amy back after publishing her second title, Wild: Tales from Early Medieval Britain, a few months ago. This time, Amy turns her attention to the British countryside, using a variety of medieval texts to retell stories and provide expert analysis on themes such as earth, fen, forest, and beast. This time around, Amy met with our literary correspondent, Hilary Wilson.
Hi, this is Hilary Wilson with the Folklore Podcast. Today, I'm going to be talking to Dr. Amy Jeffs about the new book, Wild. So welcome again to the podcast, Amy.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Hilary. It's a pleasure to be here.
It seems like just yesterday you were here discussing Storyland, which has made quite the impact here.
Thank you. Yes, it's good to be back.
So your book, Wild, is similar to Storyland, but this time you are taking writings from the Book of Exeter.
Yes, the Exeter book, as it's known. So it's the Storyland really focuses on source material from the, I suppose you could say, the Middle Ages proper, or the High Middle Ages to the Late Middle Ages, from kind of mostly from the mid 12th century onwards. And it aims to tell a story of Britain's mythic origins by retelling medieval source texts chronologically, starting before Noah's flood, with the giants quarrying the stones that become Stonehenge, and running all the way through to the Norman conquest via the foundation of Britain, the foundation of the Scottish race, and the foundation of the English people. So Wild is slightly different in that while it also has stories followed by commentaries, non-fiction commentaries in each chapter, and is also illustrated with relief prints, the stories aren't retellings. They are short stories inspired by these much earlier sources. So sources from sort of the 6th through to the 11th centuries. And what it seeks to do across 7 themed chapters entitled Earth, Ocean, Forest, Beast, Fen, Catastrophe, Paradise, is explore an old idea of the wilderness and our psychological relationship to it.
I thought that this was much more primal, in its approach. Mm-hmm. It felt a bit more similar to the fantastic prehistoric stories that you were discussing within Storyland, while mm-hmm. also being more relatable in a way, because each of the stories was focused upon such a visceral experience.
Yes.
The first of the themed chapters, Earth, was inspired by the Wife's Lament, correct?
Correct, yes. So you mentioned the Exeter book already, and I really should have dwelled on that slightly more, because so that's a manuscript in Exeter Cathedral, it's from around 970 it was made, and then by 1072 it arrived at Exeter Cathedral upon the death of the Bishop of Exeter, Leofric, and it must have been in his collection, because then it ends up in the cathedral and has been there ever since. So Exeter Cathedral, you know, it's one of these amazing places that there has been some building of that institution on that site for hundreds of years, and this book has been there too. And it's one of the four surviving big compendia of Old English verse. Mm-hmm. And if we didn't have it, we would lose this amazing record of how emotionally subtle our Old English speaking forebears were, and also kind of their quite obscene sense of humor at times. And it's an amazing book, because it has, you know, it's got a life of St. Guthlac about this kind of heroic saint that goes out into the fens and makes his home in a prehistoric barrow. But first he has to exorcise a whole load of incumbent demons. There's also three animal poems called The Partridge, The Panther and The Whale, which isn't a trio you find elsewhere, I imagine. They describe the purported behaviors of those animals, and then give them a kind of Christian allegorical reading, but they're pretty funny and kind of mad. There's also 95 Old English riddles, which speak from the perspective of the object, of the solution.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are you know, very imaginative sort of descriptions of writing being like ploughing a furrow, that kind of thing. There's one that at least one that is really quite salacious, like it says, you know, I stand up straight in a bed, I'm hairy at my base, and something along the lines of, I make the lady's eyes water. And this is thought to actually mean an onion, and nothing more obscene if listeners' minds were going there.
I've
they
heard
should be
something
ashamed of themselves.
Similar about a strawberry. Yeah, that
really?
Is also quite salacious, and it definitely recalls that to my mind.
I think that sort of thing. Provocative fruit and vegetables. So, you know, this is something, a glimpse into the Exeter book. Among the Old English riddles, scattered among them, are a selection of poems known as the Old English Elegies. Mm-hmm. They are very much like riddles. They're very enigmatic. But they're not quite structured in the same way, and they seem to explore quite profound psychological situations through the lens of very wild landscapes, wild northwestern European landscapes, like frozen ocean or ruined cities, or this story, The Wife's Lament, which you already mentioned, this woman who says she's trapped in an earthen dugout under an oak tree, and she's been told to wait there by her lord, and she's encircled by briars and ringed about by mountains, and the summer sun edges slowly overhead, endlessly. It was these poems that I encountered as an 18-year-old, the elegies, when I went off to study Anglo-Saxon, Norse and Celtic at Cambridge, and they just completely disarmed me. I think I was expecting Old English literature to be very much like sort of Hollywood Beowulf. Yeah. And actually it was so much more subtle. And these poems that had such wonderfully evocative narrators, people like a man spinning out on the frozen ocean, his feet fettered by frost, dreaming of former joys in the hall, or the woman trapped under the oak tree, or another woman who is longing for somebody she calls Wolf, but in a relationship with somebody who wraps his arms around her, and she says, was me wintuthon, was me huathra eich lath, it was joyful to me, but it was also hateful. And then this poem kind of transmutes, and this one wolf who she's been longing for is suddenly bearing away her whelp to the woods. And she says, you hear us, the Ead Watcher, can you hear me, treasure guardian? And you don't know whether this wolf character has become a kind of enemy, whether he's turned on her. And the song ends by saying, it just goes to show you can easily tear apart that which was never sewn up, our riddle together.
Yeah.
And Yeah, I mean, these just incredible mind-bending and poems that are quite, they have a kind of narrative incompleteness. You feel like they might be a lens onto a bigger story that's been lost, or perhaps they're riddles in of themselves, or perhaps they're just mysterious and that's what makes them so amazing, and that we'll never know, and maybe they never had that wider context. So really, these are the springboard for Wilde. And while I do bring in Latin literature from Ireland, as well as some an Irish text and a Welsh poem called the Claf Aber Ciaug, it's really the Old English elegies that were the initial pole star, and to kind of explore this old idea of the wilderness.
Yeah, the story about Wolf in particular has just stuck in my mind since I read it. You mentioned at one point the phrase the horror vacui, which, if I recall correctly, you were explaining as, you know, just the fear of these empty spaces, essentially. And I felt like the story of Wolf in a way was that, because you just can't know whether this was part of a larger context, you know, if these characters were ones that were just thrown around so often, you know, that people would know what the story was, but without knowing, it becomes this almost liminal space, just like the fen that they're inhabiting.
Yes, that's very beautifully put.
It's just lodged in my head and I can't get it out. I want to know more, but the not knowing is part of what makes it so beautiful.
Yes, exactly. And I think that's so much of what we were given to read as undergraduates studying this poem, was sort of getting to the, seeing how different interpretations of the mystery, and yet there's always this acknowledgement that, you know, we don't really want to find out, and we won't, luckily. You know, I don't think there's any chance we will kind of solve Wolf and Erdwatcher. This term horror vacui is applied in relation to art which has kind of ornament completely covering the surface. So I'm sure my listeners are familiar with the treasures of the Sutton Hoo ship burial, and things like the beautiful gold belt buckle, which has a pattern of numerous serpents writhing on its surface in the gold, and they're all interlacing and tangling, and it's a real riddle in gold. You know, it challenges you to trace those individual beasts in and out of the other zoomorphic forms, and it was found in the belly of a ship that had been buried at the turn of the 7th century in the east of England, in the fens, where it would have just been an utterly waterlogged landscape with probably not exactly where they buried it, or they probably wouldn't have buried it there, but in general, of reed beds and flocks of birds and eels massively. And these, you know, this isn't purely inspired by that landscape, but I feel as though it's amazingly consonant with it, that this was a riddling landscape that they inhabited, and that the art they produced is kind of riddling too. And the term horror vacui literally means, fear of the empty. And so that these artworks are seen to be kind of expressing that. And also that maybe in this not work, there was a kind of apotropaic function, a function of warding off or confusing evil spirits. It's why we find so much of this kind of ornaments in cultures across the world, you know, very tangly knotwork on the thresholds of buildings, or around doorways, or on the corners of eaves, and that kind of thing. So these weak points where the devil might get in.
Yeah, and I was expecting, you know, a little bit reading works from so far, you know, in the past, that there would be a bit of a sense of fear, you know, a bit of a sense of fear of, you know, like the ocean, you know, which you had said in the book, the ocean was compared to a restlessness, you know, that, you know, that was the translation. I forget in which language exactly.
Yes, but I think it's in Latin, isn't it? It's Isidore of Seville. He gives these fictive etymologies for different natural phenomena. And he says that the ocean is so called, and he creates this link between the Latin word for tides and the word meaning restlessness. And he says, because it's beautiful, isn't it?
It is.
Yes, and I think, yeah, so you were going to say about fear.
Yeah, I was expecting it to be something that was full of fear, but it caught me completely off guard, reading the chapter that, well, the section that was titled Ruin. How there was this idea of brotherhood, in
Oh,
spite of, or
catastrophe.
catastrophe,
Yes.
sorry, in
Yes,
catas
pretty much the same thing.
there was this brotherhood in spite of the ruination that was to come. That we are living in the last age. There's nothing we can do to stop this, but let's still create something beautiful. Let's still
Yes.
celebrate being together. I thought that was just such a beautiful idea, especially with the book coming out, in the midst of a bit of a catastrophe that we've all lived through.
Thank you. Yeah, I felt very personally inspired by the sources that I was reading. I mean, I'd want to talk more at the end about the kind of personal dimension, I suppose, but just to kind
Of
of
course.
elaborate for listeners on this chapter. In 793, the monastery at Lindisfarne was sacked by the Vikings. Lindisfarne is on the east coast of England, northeast coast, cold, windy, desolate place. Really good fish and chips, if anyone is. And Lindisfarne itself is on a kind of rocky outcrop, an island that can only be reached at low tide. And you could at that point you can walk across the sand. The mud flats to the island, but then it's cut off again, a couple of hours later. And in 793, Vikings did the unthinkable. This was a time when, Charlemagne's court was in full swing. There was learning across Europe. There were amazing networks of scholarship and trade. This was a time when they wouldn't have felt as though they were barbarians living in the early Middle Ages, like maybe we think of it, and suddenly this fleet of Viking ships lands on Lindisfarne, and they kill the monks and steal the relics and desecrate the altars, and it's absolutely cataclysmic, shocking event. And Alcuin, a English scholar who was at the court of Charlemagne, writes back to the Bishop of Lindisfarne, kind of lamenting this horrendous event. But what I found particularly interesting, so in the chapter, I don't focus on the attack itself, but on the kind of build up to, because in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles, which is a whole load of annal chronicles that survive from the Anglo-Saxon period that tell us in very terse terms different events that happen in different years. And in this one, for 793, it says in this year there were whirlwinds over the ocean and flashes of light in the sky, and there were dragons seen, and there was a famine, and the blossom froze on the trees, and then the Vikings raided the monastery at Lindisfarne, and many were killed. And it's got this implication that there was this sense of impending disaster. And so that got me thinking about the experience of living on Lindisfarne, about what was being made there. 100 years earlier, they produced the Lindisfarne Gospels, which have always played on my, I mean, they're an incredibly beautiful book, fully digitized now, so you can just flick through the facsimile online. But they every page, every opening page of each gospel has a beautiful a carpet page, a full page of geometric ornament, followed by initials, the opening initials of the gospel, completely teeming with interlaced ornaments and both ribbon interlace and what they call zoomorphic interlace. So in this case, birds, all kind of perfectly tessellated within the initials, which then sort of flow out into this beautiful Celtic curvilinear ornament of trumpet spirals and triskeles. And these pages combine the metal working motifs of the Celtic and Germanic worlds in a medium that is Middle Eastern and classical, and it's or kind of Mediterranean, let's say. And so there's this amazing sort of coming together of cultural influences, and they are incredibly fine. Just the kind of fine pen work and brushwork that cannot be surpassed, in any age. This is as beautiful as it gets. It's up there with this kind of Persian illuminations or anything you could hope to rest your eyes on. And since first encountering them as an undergraduate, I was always interested in the birds. And I had one of those little ideas like, oh, you know, they lived out on this outcrop in the ocean. There must have been flocks of birds wheeling around them the whole time while they were painting these beautiful tessellated illuminations. And then in the sort of the same course, still while I was an undergraduate, we encountered a text called The Voyage of St. Brendan, which is 9th century. And it's about a group of monks who set sail, led by their abbot, St. Brendan. They set sail from the coast of Ireland off into the Atlantic. No idea, there's some big land masks. It may or may not be of any interest in the future, off to the west. But they wander the Atlantic for 7 years, visiting the same set of islands each year, and they've got their boat has no rudder, so you know they're at the mercy of the wind and of God's direction. And one of the islands that particularly stuck out for me, because all of the islands are pretty weird and wonderful. There's one with really really big sheep. There's one with a crystal monastery. There's one with grapes that are so huge you can live off them for 3 days. Just one grape will feed a man for 3 days. And ultimately, they do this 7 year journey, and they are looking for an earthly paradise, and this is kind of where it all leads to. But at Easter, they come across an island every Easter that has a huge tree on it, a tree so big that its branches overhang either side of the island, and it's completely covered in birds. And the birds are all singing together, and they're not just singing like tweet, 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 but they're singing words, actual words. And the brothers can hear that these are the psalms that they're singing, which is something that the brothers with themselves have spent a lot of time doing as monks, mm-hmm. Singing the psalms. And there's one of the birds lands on the prow of the boat and says, you know, we aren't birds. We are fallen angels that got trapped in the firmament in earth on the way down to hell. And we've been wandering ever since. And most of the time we're just doomed to wander. But on high days and holidays, God lets us take the form of birds and meet together and sing. And one of the psalms they're singing is how good and how pleasant it is for brothers to dwell in unity. So, you know, basically what Brendan and his monks are doing, it seems to be a kind of metaphor for the monastic vocation, this going round and round and round, doing the same thing year after year, that following the liturgical calendar in the hope of achieving salvation. You know, that's what their journey is. But I became really excited by this idea of, oh, what if the birds singing that psalm, they're a little bit like the birds in the letters of the Lindisfarne Gospels, this kind of living together according to a rule, taking action according to their understanding, to go somewhere hopeful, and to live in harmony as well, to experience that harmony. And so those are themes that that I wanted to explore in the last two chapters, over and above themes of the apocalypse and doom, you know, but as a sort of foil to them.
I thought it was just so beautiful, and I thought that there was so much hope in that.
Well, I think that's something we all need to accept, the imperative of hope. I think, you know, just before I started writing Wild, I'd had a baby and I got a bit anxious about things, and especially the kind of two things, the sort of apocalyptic rhetoric that seems to be coming from everywhere, and also the rhetoric of apathy, which is possibly worse. And it was it I found that kind of casting a line into these early medieval sources and looking for arguments that said we should create because of mortality, not in spite of it, was extremely galvanizing for me and hope-inducing.
Yeah, I love that notion, and it's something that definitely is there, you know, within a Wild. And
good.
I felt it was galvanizing for me as well.
I'm so pleased.
You know, there is a kind of cyclical nature to reading these and seeing that back then people had similar concerns to what we have now. They might have manifested mm-hmm. in a different way, but they're still there. And with the first chapter that I'd mentioned before, you know, The Wife's Lament, I thought it was extremely powerful to begin the entire book with that. And with your own journey, you know, into the barrows there.
Mm. Yes.
There's the notion of the dead inspiring the living. And I felt like there was a bit of an inspiration there, being able to see that far back in time. The idea that you can actually visit these places and experience them is just such a powerful thing.
It is. It's incredible. And I think, in there are so many places like, just so close to home for all of us, I think, that have these stories in them that we don't visit because they're 5 minutes away or we don't engage with. For the first chapter of really, it was an article by a woman called Sarah Semple, who suggested that the narrator of The Wife's Lament is a ghost and associated with a prehistoric barrow. I don't want to go into too much detail because I think there's a kind of spoiler. I don't want to.
Oh, it's amazing.
I don't want to give away, but thank you. It did involve kind of going off to a place called Stony Littleton Long Barrow, and crawling to the back of a this prehistoric burial mound, which has an amazing sort of passageway, stone-lined passageway, with chambers going off either side, and you can see the fossils just kind of glinting either side of you, and you have to crawl to get through, and then you get to the very end and you can turn around and look back. And when I visited, it was a freezing cold day outside and just icy hoarfrost, and but in the barrow itself, the water was dripping from the ceiling. It was practically warm. And when you are at the very back with your kind of spine pressed against the stones, looking towards this little circle of light at the far end, you could see steam rolling over the floor of the, I felt like this, surely I'm on some kind of film set right now. This just doesn't seem real. And to think that this for many thousands of years was a grave for numerous the skeletal and cremated remains of numerous men, women and children, and it was uncovered in the Victorian period and the contents removed, but this was the kind of setting I used for the story that opens the book.
Yeah, and it's great because that sort of setting is also a bit reminiscent of rebirth. To be able to see that and to be able to go from that to the rest. Yeah, I think that's just absolutely gorgeous.
Thank you. I mean, the first chapter is meant to kind of focus on the idea of the earth.
Yeah.
The earth is something that we, in the early medieval imagination, and probably, I mean, it's just practical, the thing we came from, the thing to which we'll return. And also, so I did also visit some caves and think about just the earth as a geographical phenomenon, as well as like an idea of something bigger. We look at Bede and his suggestion that caves are formed when wind gets trapped underground, and laboring to escape shakes open a gap. I like the way he describes the earth in very corporeal terms. He says that the earth has sponge-like innards.
I loved that description.
He talks about the veins. Yeah, it's amazing. And it reflects this idea of the earth being like a grand reflection of the human body, that that at the center of the cosmos, we have the firmament and all of the elements, according to this kind of humoral understanding of the universe. The elements are all jostling and all mixed up, and everything's trying to return to its element, but nothing's settled. Everything's kind of in a constant state of flux. And in the same way, the human body, which is governed by those elements and is composed of black bile, yellow bile, blood and black phlegm, bile, yellow bile, right? Phlegm and blood. Yes, thank you. And those are also restive and kind of trying to sort themselves out the whole time. So, going into this cave in the Mendips, which is quite close to where I live, but again, seeing a side to the landscape that I just didn't know, and I contacted the local caving group and was led down into this cave, which had this sudden kind of tunnel that you had to literally slide down, like the earth was swallowing you whole, and it was all wet. The walls were all wet. So I felt like I was a sort of endoscope, camera going down somebody's throat. And this whole idea of the earth being like the body that Bede describes and that you find elsewhere was really, really easy to identify with.
It's also a bit like being swallowed by the whale, which...
Sure, yes.
Yeah, which comes into play a fair bit.
It does, yeah. The whale is a great story.
I loved your theory that you mentioned of the Frank's casket, which
Oh,
came into
yes.
play, within the beast section. That was just striking. The analysis that you were offering of that.
Thank you. Yeah, that's something that I've been really keen on for years, actually. I mean, if listeners just heard me say the whale is a great story, I meant the old English story of the whale. I'm not just bragging about my own story. That's there's this in the Exeter book. I mentioned those three animal law poems, and one of them is the whale, and it says that the whale has this dastardly trick where it poses as an island, and it stays very, very still, and it waits for sailors to come by in their boats, and then they see it and they think it's an island, and they moor their boats and they disembark, they build their camps, they light their fires, and the minute the fire touches the whale's skin and it feels that heat, it knows its trap has worked, and it dives and drags the sailors to the abyss. And the abyss is a literal physical place, but it also has very strong connotations of hell and the kind of a wet version of Tartarus. And then it says, and so too the devil will pose as a safe reef. And you will think it's safe, and you will make your camp, and you will light your fire, but then he will drag your soul to the abyss. And I thought that this, whether or not you apply the Christian reading, has a great power. I think we've all been in those situations in life where you think you're safe and you're tripping along happily, and it all seems fine, and then suddenly you think, oh, I didn't understand this. I need to get out. I've missed, this is, and you feel the ground move beneath your feet. It could be a literal physical situation or a psychological one. But this is the kind of springing off point for the beast chapter. But I've focused a bit on an object that you just mentioned called the Frank's casket, which is in the British Museum, in the early medieval gallery. It's about the size of, in Britain, I say, about the size of a Domino's box, which is like the gaming things. Do you have? It's also
Yeah.
a pizza company, and so people. Then I make a joke where I'm like, not a pizza box, the gaming one. So I
There's
don't know if that
beautiful
translates.
images of it online. I want to say
Yes,
they're very easy to come by. So while
they
I
are.
was reading, I was looking them up and I was just transfixed.
It is a folklorist's dream, isn't it? I mean, because you've got, I mean, do you want to go ahead and do a bit of Frank's casket description, as you're probably, I think you're looking at them now.
Yes, I am. I wanted to look at it again because it's absolutely stunning. On the British Museum website, there's some beautiful images of it. And it's carved out of whalebone. And you have the quote in the book itself that is written on it that says, "The King of Terror became sad when he swam onto the shingle," which
Yes.
is just extremely evocative,
Yes,
that
I mean, it's
alone.
heartbreaking. This is, one of the things that when I was ex exploring the poem, The Whale, I was thinking, the thing that kept snagging was why would anyone mistake the back of a whale for an island? It's just a grey lump. And then I got to know the kind of the source text for the old English poem. It's called the Physiologus, and it's originally in Greek, second century text, and it calls the whale Aspidochalone, which means asp turtle, and it's a kind of a monstrous sort of mythical creature with gigantic mountains on its back and kind of shaly beaches and that kind of thing around on its flank, so that when it pushes itself above the water in that way, it would look for every bit like Mauritius or something, Barbados, one of those big islands, and you would be forgiven for mistaking it for an island. And this made me think about the different kind of understandings of the whale. On the Frank's casket, we get this lovely idea of seeing a whale, imagining what it would be like to be beached as a whale that's sort of swimming up onto the shingle, and the king of terror being sad. So this, I mean, like Aspidocoloni, it's this kind of monstrous, threatening creature, and yet he's having this moment of kind of bathos or kind of great hubris, I suppose, where he suddenly realizes he's a goner. And in the chapter, in the story, I try and explore it a bit from that perspective. But there's also this idea of the Old Testament story of Jonah and the whale, with which I'm sure many listeners are familiar, where Jonah is trapped in the belly of the whale for 3 days. And in early Christian, medieval Christians thought this was seen, and I think possibly still is seen, as a type, as it's known, for Christ's 3 days in hell before the resurrection. So you get this a lot in medieval art, Old Testament scenes being used to show how they prefigure New Testament scenes as a kind of mountain of circumstantial evidence that the Old Testament is fulfilled by the New Testament, basically. And so this is the same with Jonah, that that he is a type for Christ and the belly of the whale is a type for hell. And so it's just, you know, with this this artifact that is itself a casket, a vessel, made of whale's bone, already it's loaded with symbolism. And then just add to that the fact that every single face is carved with scenes from legend, and it mingles Germanic stories like the story of Wayland the goldsmith with classical stories like Romulus and Remus suckling the she-wolf, with Old Testament stories like this, what's the Old Testament one? Am I lying? Actually, no, it's the sacking of the temple in Jerusalem, not Old Testament. So a kind of a Christian story, if you will. And then New Testament stories like you've got the three magi visiting the Virgin and child and offering their gifts, along with a duck. Confusingly, there's a duck in front of them, which doesn't make it into the biblical narrative.
There's also a couple things within it, because it is so chock full of imagery, that still haven't been fully defined.
Yes, and there's one scene, one panel that shows a scene from a Germanic legend, and it's got it shows a kind of woman mourning over what could be a burial mound or a funeral pyre with a figure in it, and the figure is almost certainly dead. And it says in the runic inscription, so it's something like Hoss was sad because of the fate that Ertai had decreed for her.
But yeah, it was incredible, so, and your interpretation of it's beautiful.
Thank you. It's... Well, this is a story that where we don't know what the original legend was. Yeah, it seems
here,
like
I have it here. Here Haas sits on the sorrow mound. She suffers distress in that Ertai had decreed for her a wretched den of sorrows and torments of the mind.
Oh, just amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
And we don't know what the background story is. There's some possibility that, or kind of theory, that it's linked to the poem The Wife's Lament that we've mentioned a couple of times, this woman being trapped underground. And I definitely explore that further. To remain with the Frank's casket, it's an amazing moment of kind of identification with a female character. And we see this across the surface of the Frank's casket with the adoration of the Magi. The Virgin is sitting, sort of looking directly out at the viewer, and she is coupled with Beardehild on the sort of the scene next to her shows this Germanic story of Wayland the goldsmith passing a drugged drink to this young woman, Beardehild, who's the daughter of the king that Wayland wants vengeance on. And so he's wreaking his vengeance on Beardehild. She drinks from this drugged cup. She falls asleep and he rapes her and impregnates her. And so but she's also looking directly out at the viewer. And so she just makes a very interesting counterpoint to the Virgin, that you've got these two pregnancies in kind of supernatural circumstances, and then they both engender heroes. Of course, the Virgin conceives the Messiah, and Beardehild conceives a hero called Widia. But they are then on this object, which is itself a vessel, which is all, you know, we go back to the belly of the whale. You've got Romulus and Remus suckling the she-wolf, bringing in more themes of kind of the female plight or the kind of female role in nurturing young heroes. You've got this amazing enigmatic scene that we've already mentioned with Hoss suffering distress at the Sorrow Mound. You know, that possibly is tapping into some kind of trope of the woman who has lost her sons, the lamenting woman, which we find over and over again in Germanic literature. So it's a fascinating object. And I mean, you could just use it as a springboard for storytelling till the cows come home. The great thing about these narratives is that there's no copyright. They're just there for the taking. And there are great pictures online and we can just, you know, let our imaginations run wild.
Yeah, it really struck me that your analysis with it was well worthwhile viewing it as something that's, you know, wholly concerned with the female experience.
Yes, yeah. I it was an idea that I had when I was about 19, 20, and it's kind of stuck with me ever since. It's one of those things that you can't really prove, but seems well worth considering that objects like these would have, you know, they're made for a highly intellectual viewer, somebody that had access to a lot of book learning. Mm-hmm. But somebody that was also interested in the female experience, it seems. And so perhaps this was an object designed for a secular noble woman who had a very strong sort of Christian life as well, which we know was definitely the case. We know a lot of women spent a large amount of time as wives and mothers, and then a significant amount of time as abbesses, you know, in this period. I say a lot of women, I mean noble women. That's, you know, that's just one of those theories to explore in the book, and particularly using the whale and the beast as a kind of lens onto that particular aspect of the wild.
Yeah, I loved that. I mean, I loved the whole book, but the Frank's Casket was something that was wholly new to me, and I highly encourage all listeners to look this up and just spend some time meditating on it, because it's gorgeous and it's fascinating.
I think Hilary and I are now already jealous of all of you that are going to meet it for the first time.
Yes.
And it's an amazing object.
Yeah. So you know, within the book, we mentioned this a little bit earlier, but you have illustrations of wood engravings within it. And within the audio book, you relate the artwork portion of the book within song.
Yes.
Yeah, so why wood engravings?
Well, with Storyland, I illustrated it first with lino cuts, which is a relief printmaking technique where you carve images into blocks of lino and then you roll it ink over the surface, run it through a press with some paper on top, and the ink is transferred to the paper and all the lines that you've carved show up white. Wood engraving is exactly the same technique, pretty much, but you do it onto small blocks of very slow-grown timbers, like boxwood, that can take a lot of pressure in the press. It's not the same as woodcut, which is a late medieval technique. In a European context, it's late medieval, and is done on wood that's cut on the plank. So you do it into the long end of the grain, as opposed to the long sort of the side of the grain, if you can imagine, rather than into the end grain, which is much more like if you'd cut a round off the tree and go straight into the sort of how best to describe it, going into the kind of cross section of the tree, let's say it like that. So wood engraving is a very, because you have to use very fine grained timber, it's very small. These are slow growing woods like boxwood that in 150 years might not get much bigger than a side plate in diameter. And I wanted to use wood engraving because I felt as though the natural medium material had more of an affinity to the sources that I was exploring and the themes I was exploring. Storyland is in some ways a more playful book than Wild.
Yeah.
And so the lino and slightly more fantastical. The lino seemed to work with those kinds of stories, whereas I felt Wild with its slightly more serious themes and its kind of reserve needed wood engraving.
I love the illustrations. They're absolutely gorgeous, and
thank you.
You can see it on the cover of the book as well.
Yes, that's
quite striking.
that one was done in the first couple of weeks of the first lockdown. And that's how the kind of idea for the book really began, was thinking about how effectively these poems convey ideas like exile and isolation. And those were suddenly in the mainstream media all the time at the start of lockdown. And so, but we were having this in the UK, we were having this absolutely beautiful spring. You know, the wilderness was completely at odds with this catastrophe we were being told about, and it was quite hard to conceive of it. And yet, you know, we had these poems seem to offer a kind of mirroring effect of emotion and the wilderness. So that's how it really began. And you also, you mentioned the songs. Mm-hmm. Basically for the audiobook, I felt that it was a shame that there wasn't anything illustrative as there was in the print version. And so with a friend of mine called Robbie Haylett, I co-wrote 7 songs. He arranged them, and they are designed to function like the illustrations. There's one song per chapter, and they are woven through. You get motifs from the songs at the beginning of each story and at the end, and then at the end of the chapter, you get the whole song. And the idea is that the atmosphere of each song suffuses the chapter, and it gives it that distinct atmosphere, and hopefully kind of provides something that compensates for the lack of illustrations. And I actually think kind of exceeds it in many ways, because the music, you know, we recorded it with a full band, with multiple voices, with the kind of creative input of all of the musicians had ideas about what should happen where and how it should sound, and many of them had read the book too, and so there was a much more of a kind of collaborative process to the songs, which the illustrations were just me on my own. So personally, it was really, really exciting and fulfilling to do that. And the way it worked out with kind of the first chapter, the song really is like Scandi noir metal. None of us saw that coming. and then the whale chapters are kind of sea shanty, and then you get something much more like straight choral music at the end. And hopefully it traces. I mean, I think it almost, it like caricatures in a really exciting way the journey from desolation to hope that the book undertakes, with this like ultimate darkness, this kind of heavy, you know, bassy track you have at the beginning, and then this very light and kind of choral piece at the end with the flute and everything.
I thought that it was interesting to see, you know, how although there is the theme of isolation, you know, within the book, there also is this theme of people seeking contact with others, mm-hmm. to finally culminate in the coming together, you know, with the paradise chapter.
Yes. Yes. And in that final song, there's the chorus is, how sweet it is to be together. How sweet it is to gather and sing, which is, riffing on that psalm, how good and how pleasant it is for brothers to dwell in unity. And I suppose that's also a kind of I suppose it, one of those ideas that's become stark in our imaginations since lockdown, but was always there.
Yeah.
The kind of love of fellowship and the necessity of fellowship for progress and harmony.
Yeah, and for people with physical copies of the book, or who for whatever reason can't find the audiobook, the songs can be found on Spotify, yes. The streaming service, so you do can get the experience of reading with the songs available as well.
Yeah, when I was 15, I was reading I Capture a Castle by Dodie Smith, and listening to Amy Stutz's album, which they're completely unrelated, but because I listened to the album, I was like, I'd just gone and bought this CD. I was like 14, 15. And then was reading this book and just putting the CD on album on repeat. The way that the songs kind of fuse to the story in my imagination, that I can't hear an Amy Stutz song now without thinking about that castle and the sisters and and that whole world conjured by the story. I thought I just really wanted to have that opportunity to invite some skilled friends and colleagues to create this kind of aural world to go with the imaginative one.
And do you
but
hope
possibly
that?
was slight, so you can match up a bit better than Amy Stutt in I Capture a Castle, which was an odd combination.
And you point out within the introduction that that aural experience is what the original, writers and people of the time period would have gotten.
Yes, I think the Middle Ages gives you a great license to kind of throw caution to the wind and do whatever it takes to tell a story. This was a time when pictures were sewn onto wall hangings, not pictures, stories were sewn onto, well, they were pictures sewn into wall hangings and written music and told aloud at the feast. And there was a kind of flexibility to it. You also get stories referred to, like there's a prehistoric barrow in Berkshire Downs, not far from where I live, called Wayland Smithy, which refers to this goldsmith figure, demigod Wayland, Germanic legendary figure, and it's been called that since at least the 10th century when it appears in the charter as Wayland of Smithan. So it just shows that these stories were being applied to mysterious features in the landscape, and kind of getting another life in that way. So we have genres and we have media and we can just tear it all up and do whatever the hell we like.
Oh, gotta get the story out there, right?
Yes, exactly.
So are you working on anything new now?
Yes, I am.
Oh, that's
It'll
brilliant.
be yeah, it'll be coming out not it'll be coming out 2024. And I'm really enjoying writing it. I'm completely engrossing it right now. I'm probably not allowed to reveal the subject matter, but I will say that it's going to be similar kind of size to Storyland with stories and commentaries and pictures as
Brilliant.
before. And we're sticking in the Middle Ages, but there's so much to say because it's actually a
Oh,
really
yeah.
long period.
It's a really long period
Good
and it's a
1,000 years.
fascinating period.
Yes, it is. And I think this is I'm just having the most fun writing it, so I hope that people enjoy it when it does come out. And
I'm looking forward to it. Like I
thank
told
you.
you before the recording started, I'm already going to be gifting, some friends copies of Storyland and Wild for the holidays. So,
Thank you very much. I appreciate it so much, really. It's
where can people find you online, to learn more about what you're working on?
Yes, you can find me on Instagram. My handle is at Historia underscore Prince. And that's Prince as in printmaking, not the royalty. And on Twitter, I am Amy underscore Historia. And in both cases, this is Historia as in the Latin word for history, just spelled Historia. So yeah, I hope to encounter you all on there sometime.
Thank you so much for your time, and I
Thank you,
look forward
Hilary.
to seeing everything new that you come out with.
Thank you, and likewise, following this wonderful podcast.
You take care.
Wild, Tales from Early Medieval Britain is published by Quercus and is available from all good bookshops, both on your high street and online. Thanks to Amy for taking the time to come back and discuss its themes. At an event I was speaking at recently, I had the pleasure of meeting musician Susan Marie Paramore, who sings with Car Dia, a band who produce Celtic folk music songs of the land. Their work seems particularly apt in connection with this episode, and I was delighted to receive two CDs from Susan, who offered their work to the podcast, so I'll be ending a few episodes with some of their music in the next few weeks and months. I'm always happy to feature folk-themed music on the podcast, so if you produce some, do get in touch with us at thefolklorepodcast@gmail.com. I'll put links for Cardia and, of course, for Amy and her book on the episode page for this episode on the Folklore Podcast website at www.thefolklorepodcast.com and in the show notes as usual. We'll play out in a moment with the track Callanish, Sacred Moon, from the album Celestial Stones. Don't forget, if you find our work valuable to you, please consider joining our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/thefolklorepodcast, where you can pay less than the price of a hot drink each month to support our work and receive extra content in return. This also helps to fund the non-profit Folklore Library and Archive. And you can also use the donation button on our website if you want to show one-off support. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
We dance.